I'm Michael Wuchter from Wittenberg University, and this is a continuation of Bible studies on the topic of scriptural epiphanies in the Jersey Shore. And today's topic is time-bending water demons and performing polar bears. And we'll be looking at Genesis chapter 32, verses 16 through 32. This is a... from my perspective, a very interesting part of our biblical tradition. This takes us about as far back into human storytelling as we have record of. And I thought maybe the best way to begin would be to look at the text, go through the text, and then I'll make some comments on it and what this means to me and what I've seen happening in this text. And then we'll have maybe some time for your insights on what you see happening here or how perhaps the story's been used in the past for you. And then I have a story about polar bears that I think speaks to me anyway, the same things as what's happening in this Genesis text. But let's look at the Genesis text. I think most of you know the character of Jacob. Jacob was not necessarily the nicest, most reliable, ethical person in the beginning part of his life. And he did a number of things that were pretty questionable. Perhaps symbolically, the most important trick that he did to, in a sense, harm another person was when he took the birthright from his brother by tricking the brother and the father. So that's the kind of person we've had. He's led that life in the past. He's done some things that you wonder, why is this character in the Bible kind of person? But now all of a sudden he's reaching a point in his life when he has to face up to what he's done in the past. And the storyline is that he's going to meet his brother, the one that he rooked out of the birthright. He is in a journey now heading towards the brother, and it seems like a journey that he can't get out of, even though I'm sure, knowing Jacob, he would like to get out of it any way he could, but he doesn't seem as though there's any way you can do that. And sometime in our life, I think we have to step back and face up to some things we've said or done to other people, and there's a certain amount of fear and anxiety as we confront this person. How is that person going to respond? How can we ever be forgiven for what we did? So he's beginning this journey towards his brother. And we still see the old Jacob here as the reading that I've chosen begins. He's dividing up his flock into different little herds and putting servants in charge of each one of them. Now, one of the reasons he's doing this, perhaps it's been said by some biblical scholars, is if this brother is in fact angry and will come storming out of the mountains and capture the flock in anger, then Jacob can still escape with some other of his flocks. He's not going to lose everything at once. He'll at least have something to get away with. But I don't think that's what's happening here. I think Jacob is doing, looking in a very human way at how can I appease this brother. Well, I'm going to give him a bunch of gifts. So if he's really angry, he's going to get one gift from me, and he still might be a little angry. He'll get another gift, and another gift. And by the time I arrive, he'll be in a good mood, and maybe he'll forgive me. So that's how the story picks up. He's dividing these wild goats and I think some cattle into different herds. And let's pick it up maybe at verse 17. This is chapter 32. He ordered the first servant, "When my brother Esau meets you and asks, 'Who is your master? Where are you going? Who owns these animals in front of you?' you must answer, 'They belong to your servant, Jacob. He sends them as a present to his master, Esau.'" Jacob himself is right behind us. So you're kind of warning that Jacob is coming to Esau. "He gave the same order to the second and the third," these separations of the herds, "and to all the others who were in charge of the herds. This is what you must say to Esau when you meet him. You must say, 'Yes, your servant Jacob is right behind us.' Jacob was thinking, 'I will win him over with gifts, and when I meet him, perhaps, hopefully, he will forgive me.' He sent the gifts on ahead of him and spent the night in camp. Now, we're going to shift here into the key part of the story. Nighttime. This is, like I said, about as far back into human history that you can travel. The form that we have this story in, this kind of an edited form, but the form we have it in was pretty well set about 1000 BC. But the roots of this story go back way beyond that. This is a Bedouin story. This is out of desert people, desert wanderers. And at nighttime was a time of fear. At night you gathered around the fire because there were all kinds of spooks and demons perhaps out in the nighttime. You don't go walking around in the nighttime. All right, now let's get into this section about wrestling with something. Verse 22, that same night, it is nighttime, Jacob got up. Why would you want to get up and leave your camp at nighttime? Took his two wives, his two concubines, his 11 children, in other words, his heritage, all that he had to offer perhaps to the future at that time period. Got all these people up and crossed the Jabbok River. Why would you, first of all, get up at nighttime? And second of all, the last thing Bedouin desert dwellers would do would be go down near a river at nighttime. There are river demons at nighttime that separate the rocks, that perhaps allows the chaos from beneath creation to seep up and grab you. There are also these same kind of Ichthonian earth spirits that would be up on the craggy rocks of mountains at the very top, who could reach up and separate the dome that is over the universe and let chaos down in to grab you. So you never, never, ever go near. In fact, even during the daytime, you'd come down, you'd water your crops, flocks, and then you'd get away from the river. You wouldn't want to spend much time there at this in this mindset. And now Jacob's doing this at nighttime. This is bizarre behavior. Okay, then verse 23. After he sent them across, he sends all his wives and children across the river. Then he also sent across all that he owned. So everything that he was, in a sense, he sends across, but he stayed behind alone. Now, if you were sitting around a fire listening to the story, you'd think, this guy is crazy. I mean, he's asking for trouble. You don't stay alone by a river. Something's going to happen to you. Well, it did. Then some humanoid form came and wrestled with him until just before daybreak. When the man saw that he was not winning the struggle, This form is envisioned as another human being, as a male who is wrestling, struggling with Jacob. He hit Jacob on the hip and was thrown out of joint. And then this man said, let go, daylight is coming. Why do you think he'd want to be let go before daylight? I mean, what difference does that matter? It's all into who these earth spirits possibly are. They are vampires. They cannot take the light of day. And then Jacob says, I won't unless you bless me. Verse 27. What is your name? The man asked. Jacob, he answered. The man said, your name will no longer be Jacob. You have struggled with God and with human beings, and you've won, so your name will be Israel. Jacob said, well, now tell me your name. Jacob is slipping back into the old Jacob. If you know the name of a god, you control that god. But this perhaps is true, the power of the universe. It doesn't have a name. I mean, you can't say the name. And it doesn't tell him here either. But the spirit answered, why do you want to know my name? Then he blessed Jacob. Jacob said, I have seen God face to face and I am still alive. So he named the place Peniel. In Hebrew, Peniel means kind of the face of God, the presence, the aurora of God. The sun rose as Jacob was leaving Peniel and he was limping because of his hip. Even today, the descendants of Israel do not eat the muscle which is on the hip joint because it was on this muscle that Jacob was hit. And now the conclusion to the story in chapter 33. Jacob saw Esau coming with his 400 men. So he divided the children among Leah and Rachel and the two concubines. And he put the concubines and their children first, then Leah and her children, finally Rachel and Joseph at the rear. And then Jacob went ahead of them and bowed down to the ground 7 times, kind of, a Bedouin custom, 7 times of humility and concern as he reaches, as he comes forward. But Esau ran to greet him, threw his arms around him, and kissed him. And they were both crying. Total forgiveness and acceptance at that point. All right, let's look at this story a little bit. I think it's a pretty significant story that speaks to us today. The ford of the Jabbok River is on the eastern side of the great cleft of the Jordan River Valley. But I don't think it matters where this is. I think the key is that it was at a river, a place, you know, an actual place, but it was by a river. As I said to you, this is one of the earliest story fragments that's found in the Bible. It is really the first sketch of written theological confession. As I said to you, it's written down in this form, 1000 BC, but the sinewy roots of this story were retold around nomadic cooking fires and protection fires at night as the wind swirled the smoke into the mystery of the night. I mean, its roots go way back, way deep into the very twilight of human consciousness. It's not a coincidence that brother Esau is portrayed as a hunter-gatherer, and that Jacob is portrayed as one who is beginning to form flocks out of wild sheep and cattle. The entrails of this story predate really farming culture. This was before there were farms in that area of the world. This is when the human family was making that transition from bands of hunter-gatherers who were nomadic people to beginning to domesticate wild animals, though both brothers were still nomads. So we're back about as far as we have history of. These Ichthonian earth spirits were believed, as I said, to live on craggy mountain tops or in the chaos of the streams, the bubbling streams that come down from the mountaintops. The myth of Jacob and the Jabbok was first whispered and acted out across these campfires and spread by oral tradition through centuries upon centuries. And what I think is very significant about this story is that at that time there was no such thing as history. You couldn't ask historical questions. What was happening then in these stories could happen now, and perhaps does happen now, and perhaps will happen tomorrow. There is a theory of corporate personality. Let's say my tribe joined your tribe, and you had all your ancestors in history, and I had my ancestors in history. When we joined together, then your ancestors became my ancestors, and my ancestors became your ancestors. And therefore, let's say Jacob was a part of your tradition, then Jacob was a part of my tradition. And if something happened to Jacob, this is just, you know, Jacob was just a little bit before. If it could happen to Jacob, it could happen to us. If it could happen to us, it could happen to our children. It could happen tomorrow as we walk out with the flocks to go across the river. This change of mind really, there was no history. Okay, so what I'd like us to do is we consider this story. You know, we're kind of safe in this room now. We're out of the elements. We're safe from wolf and lion. Our not quite domesticated wild sheep at the moment are kind of fed and safe outside this room. We're together. We can think together and hope together. And something's happened to one of us wandering Aramaeans. And if it happened to Jacob, then by God it could happen to us. Well, Jacob in the story, as we know, never, often would not know God, often would not respect human life. He could lie, he could cheat even his own brother Esau out of a birthright. What does that mean when you cheat somebody out of a birthright? What are you cheating them out of? Well, at that time, a birthright held cultural, the cultural background of that person, the integrity, the racial, sexual integrity of that person. When you took the birthright away, you were taking that all away from that person. But now Jacob was on a journey to confront the brother, in a sense to confront the reality of his own greed, his lack of compassion in the past, his own incompleteness. I see this story as really a homecoming for Jacob, and that's what he feared. He feared the pain that perhaps he inflicted on others will now come back to haunt him. He may lose the pleasure of perhaps living life for what he could get out of it. But now he reached a point where he realized you can't do that anymore. And sometimes you have to pay a price. Jacob and all the persons and things that he helped to form him began the journey. But as night engulfed, Jacob stood in horror before flowing water. The ancient Bedouins, as I said before, would know that this was a time of terror and change. This is when the twilight creatures came out. Twilight vampires that might grab you. But what happens as the story progresses is that what grabs Jacob is not the twilight creature. It is something else. It is something that, even though ask what Jacob's name is, implies already knew what Jacob's name is, and then renames Jacob as Israel, as one who has struggled with God. And of course, your tradition, hearing that story, you are Israel too, and so this is your story. So right away, then you'd begin to ask about those times that perhaps you stop along the river, to question your own future and what you're going to do and what you're going to touch. And you begin that inner struggle. It could happen to you. But the end of the story, of course, is that he meets Jacob. He meets his brother, Esau. And there is reunion then in that piece of meeting God. Well, that's, I think, what the key parts of the story are for me. I don't know, how about you? Do you pick up anything else in that story, or have you in the past? I think when you dissolve history and you hear a story that you're to become a part of, there are two things that are happening here. One, I guess, is you're to identify with Jacob in the story. And I think there are times when, as I said, we seek within for some kind of guidance in our life. And here it's meeting the brother. I think sometimes we seek within about what we are doing with our life, whether it's teaching children, whether it is perhaps making airplanes, whether it's caring for grandchildren, whether it's going into the office to work during a day in some kind of being an accountant or something like that. There are times when we step aside from that movement of who we are. We step aside and we question, why are we doing this? I mean, what is the purpose of this? Is there some plan for us? And so all that we are kind of passes over the river in that journey and moves on. And we step aside and we sleep by the river. And sometimes at night in our dreams, we kind of go through, what is it all about? Why am I doing what I am doing? And that, I think, is Jacob waiting to wrestle with some kind of deeper meaning. With always the fear, you know, there's always the risk that it may be a demon that comes and wrestles. It may be the opposite of what God intends us. But the story is here that in the sincerity of that desire to be whole and in peace and unity, it is then that this Spirit of God comes and wrestles within. That's one, I think, part of the story.
It's a different slant on the story that our tradition has held. You know, Jacob is receiving the birthright because he was selected by God. He was destined. There was some sort of covenant with God, and he was the one. And poor Esau just left out. He didn't have the talents. He didn't have the ability to lead, and so on. And as you approach the story here, we see that Jacob wasn't the great leader to begin peace with him before he could repent.
Yeah. And he's not really called Israel until he reaches that point. He's not really fulfilled, I think, the covenant and the intention until that moment of inner struggle.
I wonder if the Jewish people still look at Jacob as receiving that birthright and their manifest destiny, therefore, to have without really...
without the struggle.
Yeah. It kind of reminds me of the passage from Isaiah, I have called you by name and you are mine. Sort of the naming of Jacob is belonging now to God. This is
me. Well, like in any of these stories, you are supposed to, I mean, it used to be you automatically did it, but you're supposed to project yourself in the story. And since you are a direct descendant of Jacob, you are putting yourself in the story and asking about your own struggle. The other way to look at the story, too, that I think is important for us, is that there are times in someone else's journey that is moving along, and all of a sudden they, too, have these questions of what their meaning is in life and what their purpose is. And they step out of that. And everything else, the party kind of moves on. And they step out, and they perhaps come up to you during coffee hour. And all of a sudden there is a question about, you know, well, what are you doing? And do you, are you happy in that? Or, you know, there's times in my life when I really question about what the meaning of prayer is or something. All of a sudden, kind of out of the blue, you know, you can kind of change the subject about, it looks like it's going to rain or something like that. And it happens, you know, it could be along a trail here. I think it often happens. Somebody stops by the kitchen and they, all of a sudden the conversation shifts from the ordinary into deep probing questions about what is it all about. It may happen at work where a colleague that you know, you didn't feel you had much in common with, or maybe you didn't even like very much, and except as a Christian you're supposed to love that person, but you don't kind of like them. But all of a sudden they say something like, you know, well, what is it that can give peace? I mean, it just seems like the world, if anything, is going to get blown up or polluted beyond recognition. I mean, what is this? What can center us in the midst of this? And what's happening there, I think, is that person is stepping aside, taking a risk at the river, at nighttime, taking a risk that it might be God or it might be demon, I'm not sure, and is asking you. And you become the one that wrestles with that person. You become the night spirit that all of a sudden gives the blessing. So I think there's two ways to identify here. I think, you know, you can step into that story in that form too. You can become the angel, if you were in one of my Bible studies last week, the one that all of a sudden brings the epiphany of God. What's powerful about this story for me is I'm kind of amateur archaeologist, and I like to go back as far back as we can go and see if in fact humanity has changed or what. And I think Genesis has it all together here. I mean, that moment when the human being became Adam and had the God gift of being able to give or withhold love and had that freedom to become in the image of God, that is from the moment of human creation. And this story goes back to that point of, even then, the understanding that God can grasp you in forgiveness, knows your name, loves you. And it's not only God, it can then happen through other contacts of other people. And that image of Jacob kind of trembling as he comes to see the brother, and, you know, doing all these things, giving gifts and bowing down and whatever. And the brother just saying, you know, come on, and runs and hugs and kisses and tears and stuff. It's a pretty powerful story.
I think it's so that Jacob disappears sort of from the story after this.
Yeah, what we have here is really a bunch of different stories that somebody's putting together. And that was, you know, how the story, the key point there is named Israel. And so now we can get on with the rest of the tradition and the flow that comes on in the other main characters, you know, the men and women that form that story. But sometimes it is kind of awkward. I mean, you finally get into who this person is, and all of a sudden, boom, you're into somebody else or a different story. Well, that's maybe that's my tradition now that is now your tradition. So we got to bring that into the story and see how God intersected at that point.
That seems like, you know, when he found out who he was, and that was the
end. Yeah. And sometimes, you know, you find a story picked up again and told a little differently, maybe in Exodus or something. I mean, all of a sudden it'll appear somewhere else in that story. Well, in the tradition of Haggadah, I have a...
I think you mentioned that we might consider ourselves as descendants of Jacob.
Right.
Well, who then would be the descendants of Ishmael?
Yeah.
Esau.
Yeah. I think, you know, it's all a part of our story, too, because of the brotherhood there. And... I think that what formed him also forms us. Now, as you know, tradition went off into different ways, and there was some cultural prejudice, too, that developed there. It was kind of the people that grew the flocks and began to settle the fields didn't like the nomads, and a lot of that leaks into the story. I mean, there's you know, these are human beings, stories about human beings, and you know, you look at that part of the world today, and there's still a lot of prejudice between the Bedouins, for instance, and the people that have been settled now into the homesteads, just as there's prejudice between some of the Israelis and the Palestinians, the differences of culture, and sometimes that comes into these stories too. My personal feeling is that we are also, you know, in ancestors of that line.
Both.
There's a good movie out again, Lawrence of Arabia, which I saw recently, which really helps me appreciate that whole culture. It's a strange movie, you know, it's exciting and all that, but just to see that Bedouin culture, kind of appreciate it.
There is, the tea ceremony they have there is kind of powerful, almost a symbol of Eucharist that occurs, and sharing with the, and welcoming in, you know, that theory of hospitality where you become one of our family and they welcome you into the tent, you know, which protects them from the outside.
Question on the family structure in the Bedouin community, two wives. Was there a limit on that at that time?
Yeah, I think, again, this story goes way back. And
I missed your question.
On the family structure, Bedouin society having the two wives was
great. In some ways, that's even continued up into today. The idea was that if you could support two wives in a responsible way, then you could have two wives. I mean, it was kind of an economic thing. You had, and there was a formula too, where what was given to them had to be of such an equal way. And so it was more of a wealthy, usually the wealthier person would be able to do that. And I don't know.
The Muslim society predicted that four wives they could afford it.
Yeah. I really am not sure. I mean, we're back so far in history there, I'm not sure what's happening at that point. Of course, it ties into who is, you know, which children in fact have the birthright and which don't. It gets kind of complicated after a while.
Yeah,
and
funny. I've always thought of myself I've always thought myself of water spirits and fire spirits, that they really were the purge, the impurities.
Yeah, I just, you know, we're back so far here. I mean, that if you get back to many early cultures, everything was alive. I mean, it's hard for us to identify with that time, but there were spirits everywhere. There were forest spirits and whatever, and there were good and evil spirits and what, and you weren't sure. But the concept of what the universe was, and we see it in some of the creation stories in Genesis, there is a hammered out dome that God had hammered out to separate chaos. And this dome forms, and the waters of chaos in that the first creation story where there was just nothing but water. There's this dome that's formed out by God, and it holds back chaos. But there, you know, we have chaos in our life sometimes. Some things just don't go right. I mean, you know, obviously this is not what God intended. And so bits of chaos come in. Well, how do they get in? Well, there must be some forces of evil that, you know, make little cracks in the dome or underneath the ground or whatever. And sometimes you look at these streams pouring out of the glaciers and the snow fields up here, and sometimes they come into the rocks and then just disappear. I mean, they're gone. They're into the glacial till. But if you're not as scientifically oriented, where does that go? It must go back into chaos, or a stream will bubble up out. Where is this coming from? And so, you know, you have all this mystery thing, and all these traditions begin to develop, and it's kind of, we all have our legends of, I don't know, chaos, the Jersey Devil, or Bigfoot, or whatever. Well, the story is entitled today, Performing Polar Bears. What it picks up on is our story from Genesis, I think, that desire for reconciliation, that inner desire for reunion with others that perhaps we have somehow become separated with. And often it's our own cause that has allowed that separation. Our own culture has separated us from other people. A desire to come back together. That sort of sense of stepping aside by the river and asking some deep questions. But this is done through the eyes of a child, too. And perhaps the angel here is a circus that comes to town. Also embedded here is the question about, is there God? I mean, you know, when you stop to wrestle, is there really a God that can come and wrestle with you? Or is it some other forces in life? So performing polar bears. Growing up at the shore, one of the primary alterations in the summer routine at beach and baseball was in those magic times, usually in August, when one was firmly set in summer waves of salt and peace, when a circus rolled into town in a few colorfully painted trucks that also held their share of rust around the fenders, a deep iron orange bleeding through layers of white and bright blue. But the rambling arrival in the early morning hours made this the best of times. The water was August warm, and the waves were finally picking up height and force, and now an intrusion of the mystical in the early evening performance of the circus among the dunes. This rare combination of primaries and infinities offered to the child of any age the good life. It was always a small ragtag but genuine tent circus that would set up their modest one-ring bulge of flag-topped canvas just west of the dunes on a patch of earth that was more sand than scrub grass. But to fully appreciate the transforming potency of a seaside circus, which didn't come every year, one must appreciate the aurora of expectation that was built into one's young heart weeks before the circus's actual arrival. The circus would hire some advanced person who lazily drove around in an old beat-up white-finned Cadillac. It would cruise through the morning mist like an offshore great white shark, keeping a week or so ahead of the circus. This so-called public relations person, not a John the Baptist type, but more akin to a shabby Gabriel, coming with a message of good news to us poor shepherd children on the sandy slopes of the beach. Not a slick Madison Avenue sell you what you don't want or need kind of guy, but rather a red-faced messenger of good news in plaid polyester who made sure the local Kiwanis and Lions Club was selling tickets to all their friends and family. And more important for the mind and imagination and hope of a child, this man of public human relations made certain that the town was plastered with circus posters, large posters that would just appear like the Bethlehem Star, brightening the shingled grays and bleached tans of a sleepy two-block long line of stores that formed the downtown. Glorious, surreal circus posters filled with animation and dimension distortions, building anxious anticipation when you walk by them, scotch taped up crooked in the window of Ware's Pharmacy or Dempsey's Hardware or the Inlet Outlet Surfboard Boutique. Like the Christmas Star, the proclamation seemed to promise the impossible. The circus is coming. The circus is coming to our little town by the undulating, unrelenting sea. And do you know what gifts it was offering to us poor beggars? Those bright posters, the shiny red and black inks lapping over the borders, promised us one summer, and I remember this accurately, hundreds of performers from around the globe. And the same posters promised us two herds of performing elephants. Now remember, we're not talking about Madison Square Garden or the phony excesses of wealth and film delusion of national TV and the circus of the stars. We're not talking about Ringling Brothers and Barnum & Bailey circus housed in some stale convention hall or those recent dome temples built to honor the war gods of professional sports. I'm invoking the memories of a small tent circus that would arrive in the middle of the night in a few old trucks and set up a patched-up, raw, canvas-colored tent down by the living sea. These glorious tent promises all began to build a tremendous amount of anticipation in a young, tall, lanky boy who had some real trouble hitting low inside fastballs and was getting very tired of baseball by mid-August. But most of all, what hooked my mind and soul into an incredible amount of hope for this coming spectacle of human and natural and perhaps supernatural achievement was the grandest of all promises. Pictured in the center of the oversized circus poster that particular year, with teeth bared and claws reflecting light, reaching out at you, trying to pull you also into the very center, was a humongous white bear with glowing eyes. In large letters, the poster proclaimed and promised to me a circus of premeditated action featuring performing polar bears. Now, at this point in the remembrance, it's important for you to know that I'm very fond of polar bears. During visits to the Philadelphia Zoo as a child, I would fantasize about releasing the polar bears. Polar bears laying sprawled on the cement floor of their outdoor pit, its cement walls painted white to simulate ice, Cracker Jack box floating in tepid pool that always seemed to be half-filled, leaving rings of previous water lines stranded above them like bands of seaweed lining a low-tide beach. Heat waves would rise from before the bears' unmoving bodies, bodies pressed to the wall for shade. On a sixth grade trip to the Bronx Zoo, I convinced our classroom mother to have my group of 10 wild classmates eat our box lunches of bologna sandwiches, Wise potato chips, and cartons of warm milk near the New York polar bears that were about as emotionally damaged as their Philadelphia cousins. But now in my hometown, where there was the safety of my own house and room and the returning tide, there was going to be hundreds of performers from around the globe and two herds of performing elephants. And most incredible of all, live and in person, up close and personal, my God, intact and healthy, growling and moving, performing polar bears. At the Kiwanis Club Thursday night dinner of thin-sliced, iridescent roast beef, mashed potatoes, and green beans salted with rubbery slivers of almonds, my dad purchased circus tickets for the whole family. The actual night of the circus, we parked the family car in a brown, grassy lot and walked towards the sea through the short, loud midway with its blinking lights and cotton candy machine, and through the open mouth of the mobile canvas universe. We squirmed onto splintery benches high and front and center, warm and musty together, I curled my toes so as not to lose my rubber thongs to the abyss under the bleachers. And there was a lot of other families there, infants to the aged, all crushed together, speaking in tongues, it seemed, a rabble of anticipation. Three musicians began playing some amplified instruments, and the still night air was charged with the presence of Advent. I resisted the persistent hawking of giant coloring books and the pale blue and pink cotton candy that discolored the lips and fingers of all the children around me. I was there for more important things, ultimate things, for performing polar bears. The formal drama began in the single ring with lots of crackling noise spilling from dusty speakers hanging on wires over us and roaming spotlights illuminating nothing in particular, all surrounded by the blurred patterns of color formed by faces and t-shirts surrounding the ring in our oval of communion. And where were these hundreds of performers from around the globe? Well, actually, there were three different family units that performed. A slim, dark-skinned mother and father and some bouncy children who did juggling and balancing, a lot of running about, clapping hands and bowing deeply. And there was a plump woman and someone who might have been her husband who stood just outside the ring in the bright lights, a pack of cigarettes rolled into his shoulder and the sleeve of a once white t-shirt. He rolled out little cages on wheels. Together, this woman and man, communicating with each other silently, did the animal acts. And the third performing family was composed of a father with two sons in their early 20s and a teenage daughter. They did the strength and high wire acts. What was missed by most in the stands, out of an honest respect for the moment, was that while a new act was being introduced by the tall, garish ringmaster, the family that had just performed was running back to their Winnebago, parked outside just beyond the performance's entrance, where they would quickly change into a different costume and reappear two acts later as different people. They would be introduced one moment as the great Walinskis from Poland, only to reappear for the next act as the amazing Ruiz family from Argentina. But it really, in reality, didn't matter. The enclosure of the tent genuinely held the desire for cross-cultural integration and transformation. And these performers were not beautiful people in the eyes of any cultural prejudice seeking physical perfection. Those overweight held no hint of wealth or pampering, and some were obviously slowed down a bit by age. Yet it was all accepted and applauded in the environment of respect. The parade of difference was all glitter and flash and color and accepted. If one wished to look deeper, the costumes were well worn with signs of repair, but no one wished to inflict pain with criticism, not this night of union and celebration. These trappings of the circus drama were joyously acceptable with the so-called paying customers, because we were all there as guests of a greater force, and all there to enjoy the moment together. And we all had visible signs of repair, or the need for repair, if we cared enough to look deep into the eyes of each other. And two herds of performing elephants? Well, actually, there were elephants, three genuine elephants. A mother and her baby performed first, tramping around the ring, the baby shaking its head at flies, as the mother placed a foot on a little sturdy wooden barrel, trunk held high, ears extended. Later in the show, the other elephant was brought out into the lights, a large old Indian female with ragged ears and freckles who was very wise. She knew many tricks, which she did slowly and deliberately with a smile revealed through her huge brown eyes. She obviously had been performing in such sawdust and sand circles for decades upon decades, and now only at night dreamed of forests and streams in Indian hillsides. And for the grand finale of the whole pocket circus, with a three-member band playing like crazy, the two herds were combined, and all three elephants were together again, holding tails and kicking up sand, and we all cheered wildly. And what about performing polar bears? No one ever made mention of them. Right before intermission, the older woman and her thin, quiet male helper, did put some goats through a series of tricks. And they were white goats. And it was neat because I'd never seen or even envisioned performing goats before. But no mention was ever made of polar bears. Was I crushed by this apparent failure of the interpreted hope that was held so apparently clear on oversized red, white, and blue posters of promise? Was I greatly disappointed? Did I lose faith? No, actually, genuinely, it was okay. I mean, better than okay in the sense of more complete. The family was together, eating salty popcorn in a big old musty tent with a lot of others, families and singles, male and female, and many of my school friends unified in non-aggression. And the evening sea breeze greatly billowed and flapped the canvas like the sail on an old Georgia Bank schooner, keeping us cool in our closeness. And like a schooner nosing into the morning fog bank, we were transported out of the ordinary. The performance before us kept secret the constricting difficulties of living out of hot trailers and tracking in mud, the irritation of confinement, moving from town to town, waiting in coin-operated laundries, worrying about health insurance, winter jobs, and the schooling for restless, transient children used to the spotlight. But at the moment before us, they were offering a gift of not delusion, but pleasure. And in those moments under the canvas, all of us at the shore came together. And it was good to be together in a harmony that even, and now this is my childhood perception, that even welcomed these performers and animals from around the globe. For this hour or so, there was no room for anxiety. There were no grades to worry about or low inside fastballs or acceptance or sickness. It seemed that people had reached to the very core of available humanity and treated each other with joyful respect. In the circle of our attention, there was, for these precious moments, no separation of rich or poor, white or black, female or male, young or old. We all sat together in a crowded canvas tent on the same splintery benches with no gradations of price for location. All our tickets for this small circus were of equal value and were all valid. It was a taste of the kingdom. But later, days later, when the circumstances and disappointments of life, even along the summer beach, seemed to threaten to tip the scale towards the thunderclouds of despair, I did wonder about those great white bears. In a reflective mood, a respected adult listened to my wonderment and said to me, "You know, Michael, there is no such thing as performing polar bears. Polar bears are solitary creatures of great strength and independent nature. You can't train them to perform. There is no such thing as performing polar bears." Although others may lay out detailed formulas to prove such expressions of absence and offer self-confessions of non-belief that are based on their own experience of ultimate aloneness, there is a more prevalent sense of truth that inculcates me with a near certainty, an inner certainty, that there is a force of purpose that transcends our own corporate ability to decide what is right and what is wrong for the moment in which we find ourselves. Something certainly greater than rule by the majority. There is one can sense with a surprising clarity in times of supportive human community or when engulfed with natural balance, as when listening, for example, to the twilight sounds of water and life emerging from the mud banks of a saltwater estuary, a harmony in life that is pure and even just when the human is present and the balance is maintained. Human balance, which can be spoken of as love, as that which defines the way that relationships were intended to be. Faith implies that intention. And the intention of human harmony seems embedded in self-giving. And when people or governmental powers or the religious dogma of a moment interfere with this centering, humbly defined as love, there is a need for justice to return the balance. Children know this unless they're patterned or tricked or beaten out of the insight. Something just beyond oneself. And it must be personal. And so I walked the beach and tried at that age of 10 to understand the call and subtleties of justice, even when people told me the source of the call did not emanate from beyond the web of impulses and experiences that form me. It did not exist in any tangible or intangible form, I was told. It is hope tricking mortal flesh to believe in the impossible. Or they would say that what there is of pure God is locked in gene or active atom and already here in its finality for you. But something else gives the strength to wail and walk along the water and know that there are new forms of final surprise. But there is no such thing as performing polar bears. That is what I was told. In a very recent summer, in August, in a hot landlocked state, Ohio, ruled by humidity and slow movement and the absence of a beach, one catches oneself harboring the distinct feeling that maybe summer has overstayed its welcome. It was precisely that kind of late inland summertime when the Clark County Fair is held. Now, I personally believe that God intended fairs to be held after the harvest, when wine sap apples are crackling hard yet edible and pumpkins are available and the evenings turn cold and threaten with the kiss of frost. But this particular searing August heat made me desperate. So late one afternoon, I took my beach-starved children to the county fair. And it was just as I feared, heat and dust. Scruffy, rude young males with tattooed arms harassed us. Stretching out of wooden booths, they attempted to shame us into spending our money on wheels of chance or their more modern variations, such as hammering a lever and catapulting a slimy rubber frog onto plastic lily pads circulating in tepid tanks of water. Along a dusty, hot back corner of the fairgrounds, there were sideshow remnants where for a price one could enter a little tent or trailer and view some human deformity with no sea breeze to cool things off and whisper about the sacredness of uniqueness. And there were, of course, amusement rides run by teenagers with hollow eyes, smoking cigarettes, talking loud and boastful to young women in halters and cut-off jeans. We dutifully went through the motions and did what reportedly brought instant joy at such places and headed straight for the junk food. Long, thin strings of greasy, burn-your-mouth sizzling with extra shakes of salt from large dented aluminum containers and then drenching in wine vinegar spilled out of elongated slippery glass cruet French fries. It was then that my two children talked me into an amusement ride, which I did not find at all amusing. The three of us crammed into a small circular open car that would individually spin around as the whole configuration of other cars, identical to ours except for bright colors, would spin around in the heat and dust. This was all quickly followed. The waiting line was short and I was led there dazed by my children. By being seated on a bench seat, legs hanging free on a Ferris wheel, which spun me in a completely different direction than the previous ride. It seemed as though French fried grease was flung by centrifugal force into one heavy lump deep within my stomach. This was all compounded by the continuing intense heat and mouth-crusting dust and the swirling sights and sounds around me of greed and human deformation. I became very ill on that Ferris wheel. Now, under normal circumstances, after standing in a line for 20 minutes or more, amusement rides at county fairs last about 45 seconds, it seems. But this ride was an antithesis. There was no line, The young male operator of the ride became engaged in an animated conversation with a thin young woman with long, stringy, streaked hair. And it must have been an intense conversation. And there continued to be no one at all waiting to get on this Ferris wheel. So he just forgot about us, orbiting in the air above the fairgrounds. We just went round and round and round, seemingly forever. And I was certain that I was going to die. In fact, after a few minutes, there was even the will for death. Around and around and around we went, like packed herring in a wooden ware. And then my son found great pleasure in rocking our open car. And it seemed clear that sickness and death and chaos ultimately ruled our life together. I consciously tried to hold the pieces of my inner health together just a little bit longer, just to hang in there and not expire on an inland Ferris wheel above a dry sea of rigid, silent corn stalks, to live just long enough to get back to the sea. Perhaps by focusing one's eyes and inner self on some stationary object below would stop my head and stomach from joining in a conspiracy of surrender. So I desperately looked out beyond the ragtag midway and over the low bleachers that served as a grandstand and focused my eyes on a sun-yellowed grassy field ringed by an old sulky dirt track. And in the middle of the field, it appeared to me, could this be, polar bears. There were polar bears centered in the middle of the parched grassy oval infield before me. Polar bears in August in the sealess arid Midwest. Right there before me, as I was held captive in the grasp of an out of control human-made mechanical instrument apparently designed to combine rotation with torture. And this end of times, was this a vision or an illusion born from an overdose of shoestring French fries and the searing heat? Was it pure hallucination? Or did they, these white polar creatures of strength and vitality, did they live even here? And they did exist. At that particular time and place, they were real. And their very reality healed. As the wheel finally ground to a stop, its circular journey ended, and we were released, spilling out and back on to the midway. A loudspeaker on a gray, weather-worn pole before us proclaimed with a thunderous echo that in 10 minutes there would be available for all takers a free circus performance in front of the grandstand. We and the other fairgoers who accepted the offer joined a procession to the low bleachers of the grandstand, and there we shared, close together, splintery wooden seats, expectation, and for me, once again, whole memories of genuine union. A large, puffy white cloud gathered over us and offered us some shade, a breeze shaking the August feet corn tassels and rhythmic waves beyond, blew off the infield and flowed over us. And we were all together again, all these people with others, these once strangers and neighbors close together now, sharing expectations and excitement. And I remembered. The nausea and the pain were now gone. And it was the same again. Three families would appear at alternating times out of their Winnebagos to present various acts of balancing, strength, magic, and comedy. They seemed to be from all areas of the globe, these three families. And then the grand finale. From behind a spacious canvas curtain strung from aluminum supports and steel cables and into a large circular portable cage ambled genuine white, thick-necked, pointed-nosed polar bears, bear after bear. The last one, the fifth one, over 7 feet tall and 1,000 pounds. There before me, for me, polar bears were about to perform, and I was not forsaken or deceived. And they did perform. I mean, not Macbeth or Death of a Salesman, certainly. Yet they, pushed each other around in a low, heavy, dusty wheelbarrow, and they slid down a sagging, sliding sliding board, and they walked on their hind legs. And as they went through their motions, their tongues hung out in concentration. And it was a performance, a gift, and they were alive. Flesh and blood like me, these creatures, a genuine reality, sharing space and time with me, a fragment of my history, a point of unity and grace that closed the gaps in the dome, preventing chaos from pouring down. Performing polar bears, transformed into reality. Real flesh and blood here to share the heat and dust of our life together, more than just our hope alone, more than our desire, but the base rock of reality, the root of all things human, now called into final harmony. And I now see that they were real all along. When we are joined together in those other times, even white goats jumping through hoops can be avatars of final purpose.
Yeah.
The parts of that story are real. I mean, they're. As a kid, I remember the posters, with performing polar bears, performers from around the globe, two herds of performing elephants, and performing polar bears. And went to the circus and was waiting, and as the circus went on and you got into it, I forgot and went out and later thought, where were those polar bears? And in reality, just last year in Dusty, Ohio, out in the middle of this field from the Ferris wheel, there were five polar bears that they were hosing down with cold water that came. As I said before, there are times in our life when we begin to question and wonder and doubt and wonder about the reality of God and what is God's intention for me, and I'm teaching at this school and who cares, and I go to work each day and I make these machines and who cares, and I work with these other people that have problems and I don't know whether I'm helping them and what is it all about and what's the final goal. And we step aside, and then all of a sudden, perhaps, a spirit comes and wrestles with us and centers us. And the reality of living Christ that shares our flesh and blood was there always and is there at that moment, and promises to be with us. Us as Israel, who has struggled with God and yet is promised into the promised land. On the other hand, there will be times when we feel in harmony and at peace with God. And all of a sudden, somebody at coffee hour will put an arm around you, or a neighbor will come over to share some tea, or a colleague at work will say, I just can't take it anymore. Or, who cares anymore? I'm really getting run down and depressed, and I need to step aside, and I just am not happy anymore. And you become then the spirit. You become the performing polar bear. You become the grasp of God by the river to bring the peace of God. It's a powerful story from Exodus. So it's coffee hour time, and maybe there you can be the spirit. Thank you.